Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
All right, welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chi Man Chu, and I'm not joined by Justin Burke tonight, but I have some amazing people. I have with our team Dr. Sam Mazur and Dr. Steve Wilson. Say hi, guys.
Hey.
Hey, everyone.
Tonight, we have amazing guests, Dr. Emily Zangla and Dr. Annie Corey, to discuss proteinuria. But first, Sam, can you remind us what our show is about?
Absolutely, Chris. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guests. Our first is Emily Zangla, DO. She's a third-year pediatric nephrology fellow at the University of Minnesota. She's a fellow podcaster and started her own pediatric nephrology podcast entitled The Kidney Chronicles as a first-year fellow with Dr. Annie Corey. She has a special interest in dyslipidemia and has pursued advanced training in pediatric lipidology. Annie Corey is a pediatric nephrologist at the University of Minnesota. She recently made the switch to only outpatient general nephrology, but has worked in inpatient as well as transplant settings and is currently the medical director of pediatric dialysis. They teach us all about quantifying proteinuria, when to treat, and the benign causes of proteinuria.
So what do you think, Steve? Are our listeners going to enjoy the show?
I think they're going to love it, Chris.
Not going to do the pun?
Which
you guys got a pun?
Which pun? Which pun?
What's your pun?
You're supposed to choose one.
Hold on.
Listeners,
hold
we are punless on this one.
Insert Joker
pun. Wait, let's ask AI. So we have two wonderful guests today. I have Dr. Annie Corey and Dr. Emily Zangla. Because we're an informal group, may I ask, is it okay to call you by your first names?
Yes.
Absolutely.
All right. Emily and Annie, thank you so much for coming on. We're so excited to talk about a wonderful topic, one that I honestly get really confused about. So I'm really happy that we're going to talk about it today. So we're going to start off with some icebreaker questions. So I was just wondering, could each of you at least explain, just give a little, background about yourself. Let's start with Emily.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on. My name's Emily Zangla, and I'm a third-year pediatric nephrology fellow at the University of Minnesota. And I am also a podcaster. So Annie and I started our own pediatric nephrology podcast. It's called The Kidney Chronicles. So we enjoy doing that. And I did my residency at Rainbow Babies and Children's in Cleveland. And outside of medicine, I like to run and travel with my husband and be outside, but not during the winter, which is 6 months in Minnesota. So I look forward to the summer.
Nice. Annie?
I'm Annie Corey. I'm a pediatric nephrologist at the University of Minnesota. I did all my training at Indiana University. I was faculty there for a couple of years. Then we moved here. I enjoy just spending time with my family, being outdoors. And was there something else?
Anything interesting about yourself? That's good.
There we go.
That's awesome. And we're not going to date ourselves completely. But looking back, I hope you guys had a good time outdoors. So that seems to be a popular thing at the eclipse and seeing whatever you could see.
We had total eclipse where I am. It was amazing.
Oh, man. Ohio must have been so good. In Philadelphia, we got clouds and that was it.
I'll share some photos later.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we got clouds and rain here.
Perfect. 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 Well, anyways, last question for you guys before we jump into some content, because we have a ton of things to talk about. So for Emily, what do you think is the best advice you ever received as a learner? Maybe for Annie as a teacher as well.
Yeah, that's great. A great question. I think trusting your gut and doing what you love, really simple advice, but I think really helpful, especially when you're trying to determine the next pursuit, the next job, the next fellowship, or whatever you're going to do. I think it's important to just figure out what you love and do that every day.
Nice, nice. And this is great for everyone who's listening too, from people from medical students to advanced practice providers. This is great advice to jump through.
Okay, so the best advice that I ever sort of received was not directly in medicine, but I apply it to medicine all the time. So it's, maybe this is weird, but it's don't panic. Everything is going to be okay. So I was in yoga, okay? Hot yoga. And we were in this like very like, you know, stressful pose, okay? And, you know, I was just going to stop doing it. And the teacher was like walking through and she was like, not talking to me, talking to everyone. She was like, don't panic. Everything is going to be okay. And I was like, I took a deep breath and I held the pose and I completed it. And then I was like, okay, there you go. So I use that all the time when I start getting in stressful situations. I'm like, take a deep breath. Don't panic. Everything is going to be okay. And then I can push through it.
That's fantastic advice.
Hey, Cryptsiders listeners, let's talk some more about Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. So here's the backstory. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Erez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Erez, selfishly, it could mean that he would spend more time with Gabby, who was spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. So what does Freed do? Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, no extra mental burden. All the magic happens in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. So Freed is this AI scribe that makes charting go away, doing your SOAP notes for you. It is HIPAA compliant, takes 30 seconds to learn, and costs only $99 per month. But you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. That's freed.ai. And listeners of Cribsiders can use code CRIB50 for $50 off their first month. So I think we should just jump into some content right off the bat. We got awesome advice. We got one-liners. We got everything. Let's just jump right in because we have four clinical cases that we're going to talk about because proteinuria can come in multiple different scenarios. So let's start with our first vignette. Steve, would you mind reading the first case for us?
Perfect. So let's start with Saul. So Saul's a five-year-old boy with multicystic dysplastic kidney who presents for his annual nephrology appointment. He's feeling well. He just started kindergarten, and he's excited to see his favorite doctor, his nephrologist. His vitals are normal, including his blood pressure, which is at the 86th percentile for his age. He proudly presents to you a cup of urine, which he collected as soon as he woke up. You run the urine in the office, and it shows 2+ protein. So the first question here, just sort of starting extra basic, what on earth is this urinalysis machine measuring to actually get us 2+ protein?
Yeah, that's a great question. So either in the office or you can even do it at home. We send a lot of our patients with home dipsticks. Essentially, you dip your urine in a stick and you're measuring the albumin in the urine. So specifically, it's looking at albumin and there's a reaction that occurs with a blue reagent. So if there's albumin in the urine, which is never normal, you should not have albumin in your urine, it's going to turn blue. And the, you know, it ranges from trace to 4+. And so the bluer it is, that means there's more albumin and that's going to give you a higher, you know, reading on that dipstick. And so really anything over trace is not normal. But I will say the dipstick tests are not, the most accurate, and we like urine protein to creatinine ratio as a better, kind of, the gold standard, and it's, a lot more specific and sensitive, and it gives you the exact amount of protein in the urine rather than just 1+, 5+. The false negative and positive rates can be up to 10% with those, just the basic dipstick test. So it's definitely not perfect, but it certainly indicates that there may be something going on if it's more than trace.
I'd just like to add a couple things. One, it's not always, just so people know, it's not always blue. It doesn't have to be blue. So different brands have different things. So sometimes it's purple, sometimes it's green. So it turns a color on the pad. This hang up of what plus proteinuria it is on the dipstick, people sort of fixate on it, I feel like. And with the dipstick, I'll just tell you the way sort of we nephrologists talk to each other. We're like, someone had a specific gravity of 1030 and 2+ on a dipstick, which means nothing to us because a highly concentrated urine oftentimes gives you a false positive on those things. And we'll say like 2+ on a dipstick, like I'm rolling my eyes here. Like, who knows what that means? So the dipsticks are really good. If they're completely negative, great. If they're 4+, really, really positive, also great. Except if you have gross hematuria, there's protein in blood, which will also give you a lot of protein on the dipstick. Outside of those two scenarios, that negative or really positive helps you. And those two in the middle, you don't really know. It means you need further testing.
I'm going to ask a very basic question. Maybe I should have known this because I've been practicing a while now. So are we using albumin as a surrogate, or do we actually care about other proteins on there? So that's my first question. And I'll let you answer that first.
Yeah, so we do. There's more than just albumin that can be in the urine. The way we like to think of it is the glomerulus and the tubules. You know, those are the basic structure of the nephron and the kidney. And if something's wrong with the glomerulus, albumin can leak into the urine. If something's wrong with the tubules, then tubular protein can leak in. And some examples would be like the retinol binding protein for vitamin A, and then beta 2 microglobulin. So they're kind of lower molecular weight proteins that can leak in. So we do care about both, but usually we care more about the glomerular protein because that's more associated with a risk of CKD and CKD progression. But when we measure, so just a regular dipstick, you make a good point, isn't going to pick up other proteins aside from albumin.
Gotcha.
And so it sounds like the gold standard is to get the urine protein creatinine ratio.
Correct.
Is that all proteins, or is that just albumin as well?
That will measure all proteins. The urine albumin to creatinine specifically will measure just the albumin, which we do care about. But for the majority of the studies in kids and for our patients, unless they're diabetic, we're usually getting the protein to creatinine ratio is always the next test we're going to want if we see anything abnormal with the dipstick.
Now, I have one more question about point of care testing. So when I was a resident, I remember looking at like actually dipping and then measuring it next to the container, which has all the colors on it. But right now, like a bunch of my clinics I've been at, they dip it and then it goes into a machine and then the machine says 2+ and stuff. Is it doing the same thing and the machine's just reading the color for us, or what's going on there?
That's a really good question. I'm going to defer that to Annie because we don't look at our
urine. I don't know how the machine does it. And honestly, we don't put that much stock into the dipstick at all. Gotcha. So it's good information. It's good to have. It's good for patients to be able to dip their urine if they have nephrotic syndrome, minimal change, to know when they're going into remission. But honestly, we don't really use it that much for clinical decision making at all.
And here, so this is, I think we're starting to get to what tests should we be ordering. And it sounds like it's not the urine dipstick. It sounds like it really should be the urine protein creatinine ratio. So we're going to get into this in a little bit, but I just wonder if you guys can give us kind of like an overview. So when it comes to pretest probability, should I be ordering, if I'm looking for proteinuria, should I be skipping the urine dip and ordering the protein creatinine ratio? Or is there at least some negative predictive value in the urine dip that's high enough to say, hey, if I see anything positive, I'd order that. But if the negative predictive value is high enough, I can just skip it if it's zero.
No, there's definitely still a place for urinalysis because we also like to know, is there blood in the urine? You know, are there white blood cells? Is there leukoesterase that you're worried about, potentially an infection? What's the spec grab? You know, is the kid dehydrated or not? So yes, but there definitely can be scenarios if you're really only looking for protein, but that's going to be someone with a known, you know, nephrotic kind of protein that you're literally just monitoring that. But I think for the general pediatrician and definitely the first step, you're going to want the whole urinalysis plus a urine protein to creatinine ratio. So we like to look at both of them.
Gotcha.
So one question I have is, why do we need to compare it to a creatinine? I've seen people get like a 24-hour urine, and then we equate it to protein creatinine ratio. I know there's something about maybe some variation. Can you explain why we need that ratio to sort of make this evaluation?
Because you really want to know, the concentration. So if someone has a really dilute urine, and their, you know, their protein may be really low if you just look at the protein, but I don't know if I'm saying this totally right. I might be mixing up in my head, but you need to make sure it's kind of the correct concentration. So, cause it, if you just check the protein in someone's urine sample, you have no idea like how concentrated their urine was, how much, you know, urine they produce. So you really need to have both to get a good accurate concentration. And that's how it's validated kind of when you compare it to a 24-hour urine collection, which we know in kids is very hard to do.
And then, so I have one last follow-up, unless, Annie, you wanted to jump in on that one. So I think this brings us to kind of the last point of this kind of question of just talking about how we test it, what we get, you know, what's in it, all that type of thing. So what actually qualifies as proteinuria on these tests? Like, what's the cutoff for you guys to say that's proteinuria? You don't need to tell me how much, but just like, is it positive proteinuria or negative proteinuria?
Yep. So 0.2 grams of protein per grams of creatinine. Anything above that is abnormal.
Yeah, so I'll just pop in on this one real quick here. So you're talking about the protein to creatinine ratio. Anything above 0.2 is considered abnormal. Totally agree. Just one thing to make sure is sometimes your lab will put like not do the ratio for you, and they'll put like the protein in one unit and the creatinine in another unit, and then you're dividing by different units and you get either a very abnormal value or a very normal value. And it could be wrong. And I've had plenty of patients referred for either one of those.
So now I think we have a pretty good understanding of what we're getting on a test. You know, it sounds like the dip is at least dipping for albumin, or protein creatinine ratio is dipping for everything. The dip is not that sensitive / specific, but at least gives us a fair amount of information. If we're looking for gold standard, it'd be the protein to creatinine ratio. And that cutoff would be 0.2 grams of protein per grams of albumin. Is that correct? Oh, sorry, per grams of creatinine. Sorry.
Yep, you Thank got you. It.
All right, perfect. Now we can actually jump back to this case, and I so apologize for taking us on that loop. So for Saul, a 5-year-old with multicystic dysplastic kidney, who's coming in with a nice urine sample. So why does Saul have proteinuria?
It's a great question. For a patient who has multicystic dysplastic kidney, I'm not sure what his ultrasound shows, but a lot of times patients, so that multicystic dysplastic kidney is not functional. That is just a congenital anomaly of the kidneys and urinary tract that in utero often it's picked up, and essentially it's just cysts that are not communicating have taken over the kidney because of a developmental malfunction. And so really, I'm assuming Saul has another normal, healthy looking kidney that may be large and compensating for his lack of function for the other kidney. So what we can see over time in some patients is that they have kind of a compensatory hyperfiltration. And over time, that can cause an injury to the glomerular basement membrane. And remember, just thinking about the kidney structure, if we go back to medical school, you have three layers between the blood vessels that supply the kidney and the urinary space. You have your endothelial cells, so those, you know, between the urinary space and the blood vessels. Then you have the glomerular basement membrane. Then you have the podocytes. So if something's wrong with any of those layers, you can leak protein, specifically in the glomerulus, it's albumin. And so with hyperfiltration and patients who maybe have one kidney, or they've had scarring over time, they have diabetes, they're overweight, there's so many things that can cause this hyperfiltration, you know, injury, but that can cause pressure and damage to the glomerular basement membrane and cause proteinuria. I don't know, though. Saul kind of seems kind of a little young for that. It can take a long time for that kind of injury to develop. So I'm not putting too much stake in one urine protein to creatinine ratio. I think for Saul, I'm going to need to see a trend before I assume that that's exactly what's going on, because there's a lot of reasons for proteinuria. That's one of them, but there's some more, you know, kind of transient things that can happen. So I love that he got a first morning urine. That's something that is kind of the next step. If we ever see proteinuria, we make sure it's a first morning sample, because there's something called orthostatic proteinuria. And what that means is just walking around in, mostly we see it in adolescents, sometimes a little younger, but walking around can cause kind of a physiologic protein leak in the urine. And that is pretty benign. There's been some studies with 20 to 50 year follow-up times, and having orthostatic proteinuria is a benign condition. And we're not exactly sure what causes it, but that's the first thing I want to know. Is it a first morning sample? And then some other things that can cause proteinuria, but don't necessarily mean there's something wrong with the kidney, would be, was he, you know, exercising vigorously? Does he have a fever? Anytime there's inflammation, right, our capillaries are leaky, and that can cause a little bit of protein leak. So I'm not super worried right now with one level, but he's someone I'm going to want to keep an eye on.
So with the orthostatic proteinuria, is this one where, say, Saul is potty trained? Would he be one that could you consider doing a 24-hour protein collection? And would that even out the protein if it was orthostatic?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've never done that. You can do it. I would just want to get another first morning urine sample and make sure it's negative, because it should be negative if he truly did it correctly. Now, some families may have a hard time understanding what that means, and they may think they're doing a first morning, but a first morning means literally the kid should walk as minimal as possible, and that first sample in the morning before they've done much at all should be the collection. And so what I've seen sometimes is, you know, they'll be walking around, they'll eat breakfast, and then they'll get it and they'll be like, oh, well, I got it first thing in the morning. But truly, we need one right as soon as they get out of bed in the morning.
Those are good pearls. Yeah.
And so I apologize for this case. This case is really supposed to be like a CKD1 case of someone, to, you know, who you're kind of walking through the, seeing them every couple months to then check to see, or maybe 6 months in this case, but trying to see, hey, when, you know, if they start to develop proteinuria in CKD, what does that mean? And you had mentioned about hyperfiltration and how that kind of came about. And this is kind of a good question. So let's just say that Saul has multiple runs, like his next follow-up, for example, he's got proteinuria, or his next one after that. And maybe say he's older than five, just because clearly I'm not a nephrologist when I wrote this. And so the
it's
question,
not impossible.
It's not impossible. There we go. Is all proteinuria in CKD from the same problem? Like, in the sense, is it all hyperfiltration, or is it different? It depends on the form of CKD.
No, you know, it's very different from different places. And there's even evidence that some albumin does come from the tubules. So, you know, it can be from pretty much everywhere, and it's nonspecific. And in a patient like you mentioned, this young, if there is persistent proteinuria, I would be in some ways thinking about some sort of dysplasia of the contralateral kidney. And or if it's significant enough, then, as Emily mentioned, we're thinking about other reasons for proteinuria, because you can also get IgA nephropathy even if you have a multicystic dysplastic kidney, or you can also get other random proteinuric diseases. So then you're wondering, okay, do I need to biopsy this kidney? But if we end up thinking it's like, you know, a protein to creatinine ratio of 0.4, 0.5, and the patient's 17 years old and no other indications, no hematuria, no hypertension, like, we just think this is some sort of chronic, maybe not even 17, maybe we say they're 45. I don't know when you develop proteinuria from a solitary kidney, but you certainly can, and we think it's dysplasia. So, or we think it's not dysplasia, we don't think it's anything else, we just start an ACE inhibitor, call it good.
And so why do we treat that proteinuria with the, or so would you mind explaining, actually, let's start with this. Would you mind explaining why you start an ACE inhibitor? And then we can talk about why we actually need to treat the proteinuria.
Proteinuria is associated with not only a problem with the kidney, but progression of kidney disease. And so ACE inhibitors can help decrease that glomerular pressure, decrease the proteinuria, and it definitely decreases the CKD progression. There's been some great studies in kids even. And so that's kind of our number one go-to thing when we treat chronic kidney disease, is getting that protein under control, because that's something that we can do to slow the progression of chronic kidney disease. And we know that anytime someone has any proteinuria, that can speed it along.
And how does that actually work for you in this case? Do you guys happen to know, do we know why ACE inhibitors, or, you know, any ACE inhibitor will decrease proteinuria in general. It sounds like you get good benefit as far as kidney disease prevention, but why does it actually work?
So you're with the ACE inhibitor, you're going to decrease the pressure in that efferent arteriole. And so you're putting a lot less pressure on the glomerular basement membrane, and therefore you cause less protein leak.
And sorry, I keep asking these questions about this, but I have one more. We're just going to kind of keep going here about, so how do you titrate the ACE inhibitor? So say this kid, we said, hey, 1745, whatever it is, not hypertensive, right? So you're not titrating to a blood pressure that is goal within age. So how are you using it to titrate for proteinuria?
So ideally, we like the protein to be, you know, 0.2 grams protein to creatinine or less. But oftentimes we are kind of stopped because patients, especially who don't start off hypertensive, become hypotensive. You can also see hyperkalemia. So those are the two big things. So unfortunately, a lot of times, instead of getting the protein perfect, we kind of have to back off because of side effects. But we try our best. If everything else is okay and the patient doesn't become too hypotensive and the potassium's fine, to get that protein kind of perfect.
In terms of side effects, what if the child gets a cough, like from an ACE cough? Is this common? I don't even know how common it is in pediatrics. And then can we use an ARB just as successfully?
Yeah. I've never seen it, but I feel like we actually do use more ARBs though. So I mean, that's definitely a side effect. And so we certainly use ARBs just as much as ACE inhibitors. So either one would be fine.
Do you have any, from your expert opinion, do you have any preference ARBs that you use?
Go ahead, Annie.
From my expert opinion, I'll tell you, I am the most comfortable with lisinopril and losartan. Lisinopril now comes in a commercially available liquid. So it's often easy. But once kids can tolerate pills, they can do anything, but usually enalapril, lisinopril, losartan. Those are the ones that I go to the most frequently.
Gotcha.
I had a quick question. So how often do you guys see creatinine bumps associated with ACE inhibitors or ARBs? And like, how much are you willing to tolerate, after you start these medications?
All the time.
Yeah, it goes up. It should go up. If it's working, it should go up a little bit because you are dropping, like the whole point of it is you do drop the GFR, right? You're lowering the pressure in that efferent arteriole. So you should see the creatinine go up. And we say it about 30%. If it's more than that, we kind of get a little bit nervous. I haven't seen it go up ever by more than 30%, but it will go up. But it comes down.
I mean, it doesn't always come down, but the benefits of reducing proteinuria are significant, such that we'll tolerate a bump in creatinine in a patient that has underlying CKD. They don't have underlying CKD. I still check the labs 1 to 2 weeks after we start the med, but oftentimes you're not going to see a significant bump. I mean, if they don't have, I'm sorry, underlying kid, like their creatinine is already not elevated. If they have a normal creatinine and you're starting an ACE or an ARB, usually the creatinine doesn't bump that much. It's only when you have underlying kidney dysfunction, I've personally seen that it significantly jumps. And it's not always, I know we talk about it being reversible. My expert opinion, if you can call me an expert, is that it's not always reversible. And I think some of the data is saying that too, but the benefits of reducing proteinuria are significant, such that we tolerate it.
So how long after starting an ACE or ARB would we see a urinalysis change? So like how often would we be following that up? Do we wait like 2 weeks, like when we're getting our chem, or would we check it longer than that? Will it take longer for that that improvement to be seen?
Usually you'll see an improvement in a week or two is what I'd say. Annie, what do you think?
I don't know of a time frame when you see it, to be honest with you. But you do see it, and I don't have a set time frame whereabouts I check the urine protein after they start it, because when you're reducing proteinuria with an ACE or an ARB, you're really most times talking about the long haul than really worrying about the short-term antiproteinuric effect. You know, like typically you're not treating someone with florid nephrotic syndrome. Sometimes you do with an ACE and like checking a week later to see if it went from 14 to 0.2. Like that just isn't what we're doing. So, I would say, it can work within a week, but also I'm not always checking for that result within a week because I'll just see it the next, I see him in 3 months. Okay, I'll check it then. No big deal.
Awesome. This is great. This is great for this case. So let me see if I can summarize, and then Steve, I'll let you jump to the next one. But it sounds like, so if someone has CKD, and you're checking for proteinuria, they do have different reasons, but a lot of it's hyperfiltration, at least in Saul's case. So we generally want to treat proteinuria to prevent progression of the CKD. And we do that by giving an ACE or an ARB that will decrease the constriction on the efferent arteriole, which should decrease filtration through the glomerulus, which should ultimately give us a slight bump in creatinine, but definitely a decrease in proteinuria down to less than 0.2 grams per gram. The drugs that we should hopefully be using for an expert opinion is roughly lisinopril and allopril and losartan. And then we can just repeat, well, we can do a chemistry directly after a week or two after starting those just to make sure your creatinine and potassium doesn't go too crazy, but we'll probably take at least a 30% increase in creatinine. But when it comes to just checking further on about proteinuria and all that type of stuff, we're kind of doing just our regular CKD labs every 3 months when we see our patients. I feel like that's a pretty good CKD summary from what we talked about. Am I missing anything or else we're going to jump on to the next one?
No, that was an excellent summary.
Sam's good at teach back, man.
I'm trying over here. I'm learning a lot. So this is the best case ever. So for listeners, stay tuned. We have four of these things. So stay tuned. All right, Steve, go for it.
Get moving then.
All right, great. Let's change up the case a little bit. So now we have PT. PT is a 35-day-old ex-full-term previously healthy female referred to the emergency department by her pediatrician for fever to 102 degrees Fahrenheit. In the emergency department, she undergoes our febrile infant workup, which includes urinalysis and urine culture. Her urinalysis is positive for 2+ protein and 3+ leukocyte esterase, and her urine culture eventually returns with over 100,000 colony-forming units of E. coli, consistent with a urinary tract infection. So my question for you, Emily and Annie, why does PT have protein in her urine in this case?
Anytime there's inflammation in the kidney, those inflammatory cells can also cause, you know, like capillary leak, and you can see protein in the urine because of any type of inflammation, which is exactly what's going on in this case. So I'm not surprised at all to see protein with a concurrent urinary tract infection.
And is the type of protein, you know, again, we kind of talked in the beginning about glomerular protein versus tubular protein. In this case, our dipstick is positive for albumin, which we presume to be glomerular protein. So you're saying there's leak kind of everywhere. Is that kind of what you're saying? So certainly in the glomerulus as well.
So outside of treating a UTI, do we need to do anything else about this?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. And I feel like we often don't see these patients. And so I don't know if there's a standard protocol for this, but I think it would be reasonable to repeat a urinalysis once she is totally healed. So I would wait a while, you know, maybe a month or two after the infection is completely treated, and you could check another urinalysis just to make sure it's normal.
So I'm going to say this. I totally agree with you, Emily, but I feel like general pediatricians are going to burn us for saying that. Because they're going to be like, we're not going to go back and check every single one that's ever had an infection. We'll be. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm speaking for general pediatricians here, but I think our patient population is such that we sort of like think like that because, of course, we see all the bad proteinuric diseases. But I think in the setting of an infection, I'm not sure that you have to recheck it if you have like a documented greater than 100,000 E. coli, you get completely better because like test of cures aren't recommended either. So I don't think it's a bad idea. I don't think it's necessary, really.
It sounds like UTI inflammation makes total sense. Diagnosed, you really don't need to automatically repeat this thing. We'd be happy to see what comes out in the wash unless you're coming out with other symptoms.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I think we need to listen to the next case since we teased it so long.
Yeah, we did. Go for it, Steve.
All right, let's change the case again. So let's say PT grows up to be a healthy 13-year-old. She comes back to her pediatrician presenting with abdominal pain, mostly in the left lower quadrant and right lower quadrants, but suprapubic pain cannot be excluded. She was ultimately diagnosed with constipation and improved with polyethylene glycol, but during her workup, she had a urinalysis done, which was normal except for 2+ proteinuria. So why does PT have protein in her urine at this time?
That's a great question. This is like Annie was saying, this is a classic case we get who's seen in the ER, they have protein in their urine, and that's probably not the cause of their abdominal pain. So this is a completely separate thing because, glomerular disorder should not cause pain in general. So I don't know why she has proteinuria. She probably needs a pretty thorough workup to figure that out, especially if it's persistent. So of course we would see her in clinic. This would be a perfect patient to be referred. So maybe she would see the pediatrician as an outpatient after her ER visit, and they could repeat the protein there. And if it's still positive, definitely send her to nephrology. So we, of course, would want our first morning urine sample to measure the protein to creatinine and make sure this isn't just simply a case of orthostatic proteinuria. We would probably get, if she didn't have imaging, we might get a kidney ultrasound to make sure, she didn't have any congenital defects or a single kidney. And then we would want to know, you know, what's the level of protein in the urine. Is she swollen? Does she have high blood pressure? Is her albumin low? Is her kidney function normal? Is there, you know, hematuria? That takes you down a whole separate pathway of, you know, what her underlying etiology would be. So there's a lot of things that could be. But for her, she could certainly have a primary, you know, nephrotic or nephritic syndrome. So those are the patients we need to see to kind of work that up.
So to clarify, it would be useful for you as the nephrologist if me as the pediatrician repeated first morning urine for protein creatinine ratio, and maybe a chem and imaging would be useful for you?
Yep. I think that would be helpful. And then, you could get a renal panel, so including an albumin, a creatinine, make sure the electrolytes are okay, get a blood pressure. Those are all things that we like. But yeah, I think the important thing is, like, you know, we like to see a couple of protein to creatinine ratios. So of course we don't want you to delay anything, but a patient in the ER, like I said, there can be inflammation going on, a fever, all of that can cause proteinuria that's more benign. But we need to see the persistent proteinuria cases. So repeating, doing like 2 weeks of a first morning urine with the protein to creatinine, and if both of those are elevated and the patient's otherwise, you know, not febrile, sending them our way.
If you're going down the orthostatic proteinuria pathway, is it important to not only repeat the first morning voids, but are you also repeating like second voids in the afternoon as well to kind of look at the discrepancy between the two and see, for example, if they had no proteinuria in the morning, looking to see if it's then present in the afternoon, or is that not necessary because you already have a dipstick showing you that there's protein, you know, midday?
Yeah, that's usually, we usually don't need to, once we see like, okay, there's midday, then we want to see, is there or is there not first morning? And if there is, then we take it seriously. If there's not, we kind of say, okay, it's orthostatic proteinuria. It's benign and it's okay.
So I actually think this is a great opportunity to talk a little bit about benign cases of proteinuria. We kind of teased it in the beginning when you were talking about your differential during the CKD. But say, like, you know, we're the primary care doctors. We repeated that urine analysis. It was positive. But maybe they didn't actually do that first morning urine that we thought. But either way, we're like, all right, this is a little bit scary. We're just going to make sure we get a renal ultrasound. We'll get our BMP. We're going to make sure we get our albumin. We're going to make sure we get our urine protein creatinine ratio. And then we send it up to you. And we say, and you send them back and say, hey, this is benign. So what is the differential of benign causes? We talked about orthostatic, and hopefully maybe you can talk about that one first and like why that works. And then we can kind of walk through all of them.
Yeah, so there's not that many. So like we said, any inflammation, fever, kids who are older, who are doing like strenuous exercise can have proteinuria right after. Like if they're a hardcore runner, you can actually have hematuria too after that. And we don't really understand why. So that's why, you know, we do like a couple repeated measures before we say, okay, this patient definitely has persistent proteinuria. And then orthostatic, as I mentioned a little bit before, usually we see it in adolescents. I looked, it can be up to, you know, up to even age 30. We can see it in younger children, but typically it's the adolescent, and we're not sure exactly what causes that. There's some theories that maybe it's the compression of renal vein on the left side crossing, you know, between the aorta and the superior mesenteric artery, but no one really understands why. But we do have long-term follow-up that shows overall people with orthostatic proteinuria do fine. Their long-term kidney function is fine, and we don't need to be necessarily worried about that. And then, of course, if you have a urinary tract infection, that can cause a concurrent proteinuria. But that's pretty much it. Everything else is going to be pathologic.
And that's actually very helpful for us because, you know, sometimes people call nephrology and we're like, oh, they might know something that we don't, some differential that is just beyond us. And so you get a call and you get this referral and it turns out it's just these pieces. But for just for the exercise one more time, you mentioned like directly after exercise. If my patient is a runner, hockey player, football player, you know, was at practice at 4 o'clock on after school and then shows up the next day, should that be gone? Are we talking like same day, like directly after? Or if they show up the next morning and they have hematuria, proteinuria, should I just blame it on football from last night? Or is that enough to say, hey, this is a new problem? It would just been like directly after.
That's a good question, Annie. I don't know.
A diagnosis of exclusion. Okay. Like I know it's in the books, but I have never seen that. And I'm never going to chalk it up to that unless I've biopsied them and the biopsy is completely squeaky clean normal. And then even then I might send genetic testing. So I am not even, it's that same thing with exercise induced gross hematuria. Like, you know, it exists, you know, it's in the books, but like, it's going to be the last thing on the list.
Awesome. And that, again, super, super helpful as a nephrologist to be like, all right, guys, this is on the differential, but when we're talking about differential orthostatic proteinuria or not orthostatic proteinuria or fever or not, and like, you'll have a nephrologist decide if it's going to be actually exercising. Don't go ahead in primary care office and say, hey, yep, that was definitely exercise.
Yep.
The microscopic blood in the urine and nephrotic range proteinuria, and that's just from exercise.
No. Yeah, we need to see those patients.
And then just for us, just this last piece, is there any interval with, you know, you said, hey, I need to see X number of proteinuria to be, hey, is this persistent? Is there any interval you would recommend for us just as general pediatricians to say, hey, get one once a week, get one every 3 months? Like, what are you talking about for intervals before we send you to nephrology?
I mean, I think having at least 2 first morning ones, they can be like a week apart. You don't have to, I'd rather see them, you know, sooner than later. I think a week is reasonable if you see it. I don't know what you think, Annie.
It's so nuanced, right? So if it's just a protein to creatinine ratio of 0.3 and nothing else, you can repeat it in a week and then it's fine. And then a month and then, you know, the next available appointment, right? But if they have gross hematuria and a little proteinuria, that's a little bit more urgent. If they're hypertensive, if they're swollen, if they're creatinine is bumped. I mean, it's all just like so nuanced that everything is just a little bit different.
Right.
Now for our final case, we have Minnie, a 7-year-old female who presents to the emergency department with bilateral lower extremity swelling. Her parents tell you she was very sick with the flu last month and has finally recovered, just to run into this new problem. Since this is an episode on proteinuria, we'll skip the differential diagnosis and the ED workup for new onset edema and let you know they obtained a urinalysis. The DIP reads 4+ proteinuria. So if we're concerned about nephrotic syndrome here, what tests should we be ordering?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, we like a good set of vitals. So hopefully the ER got that. Then, of course, we want a renal panel. So we want to know the kidney function, the electrolytes, specifically the albumin. You know, usually the criteria for nephrotic syndrome is albumin less than 2.5 grams per deciliter, plus edema, plus nephrotic range proteinuria. So of course we want a urinalysis, we want a urine protein to creatinine ratio. And so on that, nephrotic range proteinuria is defined as greater than 2 grams of protein per grams of creatinine. So if you kind of have all those things, that would meet the criteria there. Sometimes we do like a CBC and DIF to, number one, see if there's a concurrent infection going on. And then number two, the hemoglobin can help us kind of figure out if a patient, their volume status, right? So if the hemoglobin's really high, they may be intravascularly depleted. And then 2 other things we like would be a C3 and C4. So those complement levels. Oftentimes we get asked about a lipid panel. I can tell you the lipid panel, it's going to be bad if the patient has nephrotic syndrome and we're not going to treat it like right away. So I don't think you need to get that. So those are the big things: renal panel, UA, urine protein to creatinine ratio, C3, C4, and a CBC.
And then just for the renal, just for the lipid panel you had mentioned, they're going to be wonky. It's going to be fine. It's not going to help us with treatment right now. Do you need it to make the diagnosis?
No.
Awesome.
Just those three things. So swelling, low albumin, high protein.
Amazing. That's perfect.
I'll just add, you want to think about infections too, especially if you're going to be starting steroids. So I know in some centers or in certain populations, it's a reflex to get like hepatitis titers or check vaccination, look the quant gold, ask about TB exposure. I'm not saying you definitively have to do those things, but in some centers, they're already getting hep B, hep C, and quant gold reflex right off the bat. But you should at least be thinking about assessing for those risk factors because those all can both cause nephrotic syndrome, but also if you start steroids, that could be bad if you have those things and you put them on steroids.
So not necessarily wrong to order them either. Then.
Correct.
What about biopsy? At what point are you going to say, hey, this do you need to see all these positives first and be like, all right, we got to pull the trigger to do a biopsy? Or what are we doing? What are your indications to do that? Or can you diagnose and decide to manage them without a biopsy?
Yeah. So patients between the ages of 1 and 12, the most likely thing they have, if they have nephrotic syndrome, they meet all the criteria, would be minimal change nephrotic syndrome. I think like 75-85% are going to have that. So we like to start steroids, assuming they don't have another infection. If they do, we have to treat their infection. But and then give them, 4 to 6 weeks. The majority, over 90% of patients who are going to respond to steroids are going to do so in the first 2 weeks of the steroids. If they don't respond to steroids by 6 weeks, that's when we usually will want a biopsy because we're worried that this may not be minimal change and this may need another treatment and this patient may have something else going on that is maybe a lifelong kind of chronic thing compared to minimal change disease. So that's when, for nephrotics, that's really the big decision point. Do they or do they not respond to steroids? And if the answer is no, that's when we're going to want a biopsy. And then from the get-go, too, if they're less than age 1, if they're over age 12, if they have like rapidly rising creatinine, if they have a lot of blood in their urine, those things all go against minimal change. If they had a low C3 or C4. So all those things already would make us think, okay, this may not be minimal change and this patient needs a biopsy because we don't know what the patient has. But those things would make minimal change less likely, so we would want a biopsy.
Awesome. And we kind of set you up with a minimal change disease case right here. So we'll say that this 7-year-old meets all the criteria, like relatively classic. You're like, hey, this is minimal change. I'm not even going to biopsy this kid unless things don't go well for 6 weeks. Can you kind of walk us through what the steroid treatment plan is? Like, what do you guys actually do for pulse? Like, do they need to be in the hospital? Do they not? What are the doses? Kind of just your usual first line treatment for minimal change.
Yeah, so steroids are definitely the first line. I will say, like Annie said, you should be scared of infection, clots, and acute kidney injury. Those are the big things that can come with nephrotic syndrome. So I know we think minimal change is benign, and it is in terms of long-term kidney function. It's very good. But there are a lot of, comorbidities that can happen with nephrotic syndrome. So we should all be looking out for those things. But anyway, if the patient is edematous, but not in too much pain, not too swollen, able to eat and drink and can go home, then we would start them on oral steroids. Now, there's some kids that really are so swollen, they have potentially pulmonary edema. We're worried that they could have a really bad infection. We would admit them. And in those cases, sometimes we do IV steroids. But assuming this kid is otherwise okay, we would send them home on 2 milligrams per kilo of prednisone or prednisolone. So the prednisolone's the liquid, up to 60 milligrams. That's when we max out. So if you have a larger kid and they max out at 60, don't go above that. So we would do that every day. And at our center, we do a 6 weeks of the high dose and then 6 weeks of a lower dose every other day. So that would be 1.5 milligrams per kilo of the prednisolone or prednisone, or up to 40 milligrams every other day for 6 weeks. So for a total of 12 weeks. Some centers do 4x4, though. They do 4 weeks of the high dose, 4 weeks of alternate dose. So you have to see what your center does. They may do it a little bit differently, but that's the general trend. Now, some patients, like I said, they're going to have pulmonary edema. Boys may have really bad scrotal swelling. And those patients, we do sometimes need to admit them for like diuretics. And we do often, you know, some IV steroids just because their gut can be inflamed too and they may not be able to absorb it well.
That's actually a really good segue to like the alternative, the treatments for everything else, right? Remember, this family brought their kid in because their legs were swelling, you know, and parents are always like, oh my God, you're like, I diagnosed your kidney thing that you can't see or feel. And here's your medicine for your kidney thing that you can't see or feel. And then they're like, no, but like, what's the swelling going on? So you'd expect, does everyone get diuretics, or do we expect the steroids will actually help with some of the swelling and it's just the people who are having hypoxemia or something like that get diuretics?
So it's very specific. This is a, there's no good answer here. I know some nephrologists who are very, very against any diuretics because the downside is it can increase your risk of clots. And so we don't like that. So no, you should not. Let's just say you should not be prescribing diuretics unless you're talking to a nephrologist, because it's really a big consideration. And we also really care about intravascular volume status. We know their overall volume status is really, it's really up. They're fluid overloaded, but if it's not in their vessels and you give them a diuretic, that can really increase their risk of a renal vein thrombus, of a clot in their head, pulmonary embolism. So no, not all kids are getting diuretics, and the steroids, if this is minimal change, the majority of the time the steroids will kick in and, you know, even less than a week. And that ultimately will fix the swelling.
Yeah. And you'll tell them to be on a salt and fluid restriction too.
Yes. So sorry, I forgot that.
That will be helpful.
Yeah, and any more medicines, that's actually super, super helpful, because I'd be like, here you go, diuretics. I'm going to improve the lower extremity edema. And then someone's going to be like, oh my God, my belly hurts. You're like, oh, it's a clot. Okay. What, any other medicines that you would recommend giving as far as anticoagulation, anti-lipid, and, medicines, anything along the spectrum of medicines that should go along with minimal change disease nephrotic syndrome?
Definitely with the high dose steroids, you want to either do like famotidine or omeprazole just for gut protection on the high dose steroids. And then like Annie said, you want to fluid restrict, salt restrict until they're in remission. Once their swelling's better and they're in remission, they can eat and drink what they want. And then in terms of lipid management, patients who have like chronic nephrotic syndrome, who are like never under control, always swollen, those are patients we would consider like starting, you know, a statin or something like that. And then what was your last? Sorry, I forgot.
Oh, anticoagulation, for example.
Oh, that's a tough one. Not for the standard minimal change first time. There's no good studies on this in kids. It's really unfortunate. But you probably don't need to worry about that in a classic minimal change case. That's more of a chronic thing that we would try to manage on our, you know, non-minimal change patients.
Yeah, clotting in nephrotic syndrome is really complicated. I will say maybe there is a very small amount of data, mostly expert opinion, but maybe if the patient needs a line for some reason, so patient that's a kid that's a really tough stick that ends up getting, against everyone's wishes, like a port or a PICC line or an IJ or some type of central access to avoid all the sticks, that's a really high thrombosis risk in a patient that's actively nephrotic. So sometimes we'll do Lovenox or ask our heme colleagues to help us with some anticoagulation in that case. Some people make the case for patients with membranous nephropathy. That's more in the adult side. And then patients with lupus, that's a whole nother category, and nephrotic syndrome. And then patients that have minimal change but have previously clotted, you may talk to your heme colleagues about anticoagulation while they are in a relapse.
I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but which kids do you consider for like steroid sparing agents? And like, are we putting all these kids on ACE inhibitors? Just thinking kind of like long-term, what does medication management look like for these patients?
That's a very good question. So you bring me to a good a good point here, and that's a lot of patients who do have minimal change, about 75% of them are going to relapse. Usually the relapses happen in the first 2 years. The majority of minimal change outgrow it by their teenage years. But some of the patients have so many relapses that we do start to consider steroid-sparing agents because steroids have a lot of side effects, and especially when you have to go on them, you know, every couple weeks when the kids are in, you know, at school and getting sick, and that's what triggers, you know, their relapse. So there, things we consider would be mycophenolate, rituximab, and tacrolimus or a calcineurin inhibitor. So we definitely do think about those, but we kind of wait to see, you know, is the patient going to, how often are they going to relapse? What are their side effects like? So we really, it's a tough decision when we decide to make that. But, you know, from the get-go, you're not doing that. And the thing is, during any relapse, you need steroids. So even if the patient relapses and they're still on a steroid-sparing agent, they have to go right back to the steroids to get them back into remission. So that's a good point. And then, sorry, what was your second question?
No, not everybody gets ACE and ARB.
No.
Situation dependent.
Yeah.
And that's actually a good segue into a little bit about prognosis. So just for our listeners out there, kind of what should you expect for minimal change disease down the line? You're mentioning relapse. Would you mind just talking about that a little bit? Like what, as you said, you kind of alluded to what the triggers are, but if you wouldn't mind just kind of walking us through what we should expect and all the way to adulthood and when it might fizzle out.
Yeah, so the biggest one would be infection. So upper respiratory infection, especially in the fall and the winter, but any infection is probably the biggest trigger. I've seen it in after vaccines too. However, obviously it's tough because as pediatricians, we want our kids to get vaccinated, and we know that infections can trigger the nephrotic syndrome. So we still, you know, encourage immunizations, but of course you can unfortunately have a relapse after immunizations. And then, I don't know, those are kind of the big things. Annie, any other triggers for relapse?
Anything can trigger relapse. No, nothing else. And then prognosis is overall good. Kidney function is good.
Yeah, I think most kids outgrow it. I found a paper that said 80% had no more nephrotic syndrome by age 18. And then the long-term prognosis, as long as they're sensitive to steroids, that's like our big, we put kids into two buckets. If they're sensitive, if they're not sensitive, it doesn't matter how many times they relapse. As long as they're sensitive, they have a great long-term kidney prognosis.
And I think if we're getting to non-sensitive minimal change disease, we're in nephrology camp
it's
all the way.
It's not minimal change.
Yeah, or that, right? Minimal, yeah. And it's not us anymore as generalists.
No, this is.
And then if we are the primary care doctor who sees them in clinic regularly and they have minimal change disease, should we be screening these kids with UAs, and how frequently should we be doing that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the majority of the time, at least at our institution, our patients are really plugged in, and they know anytime that they're sick, they need to check their urine. Anytime that they're swollen, they need to check their urine. And so they'd probably be kind of doing a lot of this at home without having seen their primary care physician. So I don't think necessarily you need to be doing that in your office. Like, I don't know, Annie, what do you think? I think every place should have a protocol. So you as the pediatrician shouldn't really have to be doing screenings.
I mean, if you get a patient that you're kind of helping co-manage from afar because they live far away from a center or something like that, I would just say get the dipsticks off Amazon, have them check their urine at home daily while they're in a relapse and weekly while they're in remission or off steroids, and then inevitably they will just fall off and stop testing it weekly and then just test it when they're sick or when they're feeling swollen. And a lot of the older kids will be able to tell you, I feel like I'm in a relapse, and then they'll be in a relapse. So they just kind of self-do it.
Well, thank you so much. We've gone through a lot in this hour talking to you. I've learned a whole bunch and definitely things that I think I probably should have known before this, but I'm really glad I know now. I think as we wind down, I really want to be respectful of your time, and I really appreciate the time that you've already spent with us. I think we do have a handful of other to serve some grab bag questions. If you don't mind, some quick hits, would that be okay?
Sure, go for it.
Is there any situation where we should obtain a urine protein creatinine ratio even if we see the urinalysis without any protein in it?
Yes, that's a good question.
Lupus?
So yeah, any patient like who's coming to our clinic for CKD labs is not only getting a urinalysis, they're getting a urine protein to creatinine ratio. So anyone who's at risk of kidney disease, anyone who's had, you know, nephrotic syndrome, those patients need a urine protein to creatinine ratio. Because like I mentioned, and like Annie mentioned, the dipstick is not perfect for, you know, for maybe a lower level of proteinuria. But that doesn't mean it's not there.
Lupus, diabetes.
Oh, yes.
And sir, to piggyback off the question about the protein creatinine, I think we also wanted to ask, just to clarify, you know, do you have a closer correlation between what the protein creatinine ratio is and what we expect to see in a 24-hour protein collection?
Yeah, so I know Annie does them. I never do a 24-hour, but there are studies that show it's very valid in children, comparing the spot one to a 24-hour collection. So like I said, 0.2 grams per gram urine protein to creatinine ratio is kind of the upper limit of normal. So it should be below that on the spot test. And that correlates with 2 grams per day in the 24-hour urine collection. Nephrotic range proteinuria is over 2 grams, not 0.2, 2 grams per gram protein to creatinine ratio on the spot. And that correlates with over 3 grams per day in a 24-hour urine collection, which is very abnormal.
And did you want to comment at all on the collecting in the 24-hour protein? Is there anything that we should or shouldn't, any tips for us generalists when it comes to 24-hour urine collections?
Good luck getting it done, Annie.
I get it done a lot, but don't do it. I mean, don't do it unless you're going to see a nephrologist. Just don't even bother.
See, this is good clinical stuff.
Yeah, this is the stuff we want to know. It's like, should we do it? Should we not do it? Tell us what to get. Should we do it?
Don't bother doing it. Just let me do it.
It's a headache.
Okay, good.
Perfect. And then kind of more talking about scenarios again. You know, we had mentioned that about orthostatic proteinuria. We'd mentioned about fever. Is there a level of proteinuria that we should be concerned about regardless of the situation? So you're like, hey, this sounds like orthostatic proteinuria, but the number is like X. Should we be concerned in calling a nephrologist?
You know, I think that orthostatic proteinuria should never be nephrotic range. Have I seen it? Yes, I have. I have seen it. And it still bothers me to this day that it happens. But I think orthostatic proteinuria should not be nephrotic range. Is that in any data? No. Is that just my personal feeling? Yes.
Gotcha. And then you could sort out whether this is actual nephrotic syndrome versus orthostatic. So essentially, if we have nephrotic range proteinuria, we should, hey, say this isn't normal unless we talk to a nephrologist. That's very, very helpful.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask both of you, I would love to wrap up. I really enjoyed the time we've had here. Whether you guys could give us a couple of take home points for our listeners as we wrap up. And I can say wrap up a couple more times. Wrap up.
Take proteinuria seriously. Don't ignore it. Don't ignore it on the UA if you're a pediatrician. Send them to us if you don't. Yeah. And I think just like take the minimal change patient seriously too. Just because it's minimal change. Yes, the long-term prognosis is excellent, but there are a lot of things that can go wrong. Like we had talked about the infections, the clots, the acute kidney injury. And just call your nephrologist. We're happy to always help when things come up because these are complicated scenarios. And like, you know, you heard us, it's hard sometimes to give generalized, you know, this is what algorithms and like, this is exactly what you should do because every patient's different.
What do you got, Annie?
I think my tips are if you get proteinuria on the dipstick, just get a first morning void, get a protein to creatinine ratio, check a blood pressure.
Speaking of shout outs, do you guys want to plug anything else as we sign off here? I know we plugged your podcast already once. Please feel free to plug it again.
Yeah, check out our podcast. It's called The Kidney Chronicles. You can get it on Spotify and Google Podcasts. And we have a lot of great topics every month. But thank you for having us on this podcast. This is great.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids! Yeah!
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producers for this episode, Dr. Steve Wilson, and everyone else who's been helping us through this wonderful show. I want to thank our social media team on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And I have not been Justin Lee Burke, but instead I am Sam Mazur.
I'm Steve Wilson.
And this has been Chris the Chew Man Chew. Thank you and good night. Now, for those who've made it all the way to the end, and I never know how many actually do it, but here is your gift, which is another poem written by AI. In the realm of whispers where cells converse, a tale unfolds cryptic and terse. Protein, a traveler oft unseen, in excess treads where it could not have been. That didn't rhyme. Pediatric realms where growth should flourish, find instead this guest they'd not wish to nourish. Silent it slips through filters meant to catch, a sign, a clue, in urine we match. Doctors delve deep with tests in their keep, seeking the source where proteins seep. A puzzle complex with pieces askew, each child unique, a mystery anew. Management tailored, a craft so precise, medicines, diet, a roll of the dice. Monitoring closely with hope as their guide, in their endeavor, families at their side. Thus, in the dance of health and care, proteinuria, a challenge laid bare. With science and compassion, a path they pave, for every young patient they strive to save. See you guys. Bye.